Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Trankelberg, and I'm going to do something a little bit different. So Kirk Gray's on the line. Hey, Kirk.
Hey, Fred.
Before we dive into this one, because we just finished recording the previous episode outlining all of the ills and problems with our industry. So before we dive into the details of what you can do to make the change we want to see or that you would like to see. So Kirk, write down the top five things that our listeners and us, you and me, can do today or the next short while that can actually change the way we practice reliability engineering for the better, right? And while we do that, we'll take a short break.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett of Apex Ridge Reliability. Apex Ridge Reliability is an engineering consulting service that advances your product development with reliability tools, methods, cultural practices, and education to ensure you create mature and reliable products. To learn more, go to ascendoreliability.com/go/apex.
All right. So that was only a few seconds, Kirk. But I know you've been thinking about this since the middle of our last episode. In our last episode, we outlined, three or four hurdles. And I think it comes down to, we're busy, it's more difficult to do failure analysis, we're paying attention to long-term failures, not short-term issues. There's design and manufacturing are often in separate continents, if not right, in the same building like they used to be. And the list of things that are barriers to us being effective reliability engineers, in part, is using inappropriate tools like predictions, like parts count predictions in particular. Right. Before we get into all of the ways that we're not doing reliability engineering correctly in general in our industry, which we outlined in the last episode, what would you say would be the number one thing that you and I and our listeners can do to improve the reliability engineering as an industry or as a profession?
Well, the number one thing, Fred, is to study and understand the cause of failures, the root cause, the physics of failure, of why products coming back, especially during the warranty period, which is a very short, relatively short period of time to considering the life entitlement of electronic components, most of them.
And I would add, it's not just, a Pareto of here's 15, signal integrity problems or corrosion problems, right, or dropped phone problems or whatever. It's, right, did we not understand how customers use the product? Did we design it robust enough? What was in the actual physical fracture that happened, for example, is one thing, but then what was the process that led us to that mistake of not understanding how it would be used or where it would be used, for example?
Right.
So I would say it's the learning part I think you're getting at.
It's a learning part, and you have to dig through a lot of products that still have no problem, have actually no failure mechanism, or they haven't failed. They're good product. I mean, when you talk about the stream of returns from warranty failures coming back to the factory, it's really a very large percentage, almost always, that cannot duplicate the defect or the failure mode. So
I've been asking that question for years, and it's easily 25%, and it can be much higher.
Depending on the industry. Oh, it can be much higher. More than half. Right.
And I argue that that's not really, if you're looking just for hardware failures, that it doesn't turn on, for example, and it turns on in your lab and you go, well, there's nothing wrong with this. It works.
Right.
Well, what if the color's wrong? What if the on off button is too cumbersome to get to? What if the functionality doesn't actually solve the problem I thought it would solve? Those are still failures. They cost us warranty.
Right. Or what if it was in the interface between that system and the other part system, yeah. Like the connector? Right. Once you, like a fretting corrosion, once you remove the open up the connector, and if you were to plug it back in, you'd scrape off the oxide on the connector surface, and it would start to conduct again, and you'd have a good connection, and you wouldn't know what happened.
Well, and I think our advice is, though, in general for this number one thing, is don't stop there. It came back for a reason.
Right.
And it might be they didn't like the color, right? Or it might be an intermittent that, through the vibration of being returned to you, got solved.
And that's where the next step would go that a lot of companies aren't willing to do or haven't thought of or just wouldn't use this tool, and that is taking products that have been returned to the field that are intermittent and put them in a stress condition and stress them, and you will see that sometimes that marginality that came out at the customer site will appear. And I've done that. I've taken two laptops from the field. They were put on the bench for 5 days by the vendor, and they found that they CND, they could not duplicate what the customer was reporting from the field. These were real portable computers. And when I put them in the chamber and did cycling from minus 10 to plus 65, they both systems went into a fail mode that seemed to be the same mode that the customer was complaining about, which was an instantaneous shutdown. And we were able to then see the sensor that was causing that, the sequence that was causing that in the shutdown error of code. So that is where I think a lot of people, a lot of companies could find much more about their mechanisms and find especially marginal mechanisms or intermittent mechanisms, which are very significant, and understand that if they would stress some of the products. So that was one thing they do. But again, we're talking about just getting to the product and the difficulty of people getting back or being able to get the warranty returns.
Well, I think the practical thing there, Kirk, is to make that case saying, hey, look, if we can actually do the failure analysis on there, here, it might take us a couple of days. And we can solve this thing for this product and for the next and the next. We can fix our process but add value to it. So I think the one, I'm going to reserve my number one hit thing that we can do, which I think you could guess exactly what I'm going to say. But expanding on what you're talking about is that we need to learn. And it's not just the failure mechanism. And it's also we need to learn how to convey the value of, for example, finding the failure mechanism. We have to be able to talk across our organization about why we're doing what we're doing. And then it coupled with is that we only do tasks, only do activities like failure analysis or an FMEA or a halt or anything, if it actually adds value to making decisions and to the organization. So if it doesn't, if we're going to do a standard suite of environmental tests and we need 100 samples to do it, and we learn nothing from that, then, or the chance of learning anything from it is very, very low. It's really designed to be a test that passes. Then don't do it. You know, stand up and say, hey, we've got 100 samples. Here's the risks that we're facing. Here's the things we need to know. If we use those 100 samples to actually answer those questions, here's the value it would provide to the organization. It'll reduce risk. It'll reduce field failures. It'll help us understand our warranty set-asides. It'll do all these good things. If we use those 100 samples to run a gamut of environmental tests that are pretty much guaranteed to always pass, we have wasted 100 samples to learn nothing but you have to be able to stand up and say doing A is worthless, doing B is useful, and here's the difference. Let's do B.
Well, Fred, and this is what we had to do back in the I did personally with a company in the early 90s, and that was they did have good failure analysis. They did. It was a very high-end power conversion system, very high-end, I mean, very powerful. And it was used in the semiconductor industry. These were power supplies used in the semiconductor industry, and so very costly for them to go down. So every one of them came back. They did a very good root cause failure analysis. Mm-hmm. Now, they hadn't used Halter House, and they were thinking about it. But the easy thing for me to do, since they had a root cause detailed loose hardware, they showed, you know, screws, connectors missing, a cold solder joint or missing solder joint, solder, something like that. We actually looked at them all and put them on and said, what percentage of these are very likely to come out with vibrations, such mm-hmm. as a loose hardware situation, which we saw many times, a loose connector mm-hmm. or a wire clipping, a solder.
I'm gonna jump to a solution okay. for you. You guys should have bought some Torx screwdrivers. You
know? Right. And they had these things in the manufacturing process. Somebody didn't use them correctly. Somebody made mistakes. Anyway, what I'm saying is, with that information of the failure analysis, then you know what you're trying to find or what the things that you actually want to precipitate.
Well, that's on my list, is don't jump to conclusions. You know, it's in working with design teams, or it's way too easy for somebody to say, oh, there's a loose screw. Well, then they blame manufacturing. Well, do you have the right screw? Why do you have 87 different kinds of screws in this system?
Exactly.
You know, with 15 different kinds of heading or drivers needed.
Exactly. And this is called design for manufacturability, design for X.
And that all helps, right? Cool. So, you know, my opinion, it's always the designer's fault. So that so learning, right? Do the failure analysis, add value to the organization.
Realize the mechanisms that cause failure in your product.
Right. What else? What else is on your list? What else besides failure mechanisms and learning about those? What can we do today that will change our industry?
Well, then once you know this information, start to talk about it, write about it, publish what you know and what you found and how it improved your product, if you can. Yeah. That's very difficult to do.
Well, within the company, you certainly can. You can set up an internal webinar, for example, or you can do lunch and learns, engineers work for food kind of thing. Increase the awareness of the failure mechanisms and the risk, and then also the other tools. You know, if you want to talk about HALT, or you want to talk about accelerated testing, or understanding a customer's environment, setting goals and apportionment, all of those things need awareness, and an ongoing set of awareness. That's a good one.
But you know where they need awareness, Fred, and where I think they need the most awareness is at the top layers of management.
Yeah.
And when I had the success that I did at this one company in Colorado here, it was because I got in front of all the executive team, and the president, CEO, the chief operating officer, all of the treasurer, even the treasurer, sat in and in a 30-minute, I think it was an hour maybe, presentation on HALT and HAS using their own data of what the failures were. Where I couldn't show that outside the company, but inside the company, I could show all the things that were from the failure analysis of the return systems, is saying 85% of them, not 100%, 85%, because there's no 100% test, but 85% of them could have been found by thermal cycling and or vibration, and even faster if you did it combined. Mm-hmm. So that was instrumental in getting the rest of the company to follow, because then it wasn't trying to, and I do explain this in one of my chapters, why it's so difficult in my book, mm-hmm. is that you've got to educate them. Otherwise, you're serially educating everybody and fighting little fires all the time. You've got to get a group understanding of the idea of going from what failed in the field to what we're going to test and how we're going to test to find these before they get to the field.
Well, you know, I'm going to back up a little bit. I don't think testing in and itself is going to, I think the education piece is critical. Well, before you go to testing though, it's understanding why you're testing.
Right.
You got to think that through, and you got to think you know, if I'm, if like you were mentioning, is that we have these kinds of failures in the field, and vibration or thermal cycling would expose those for us.
Right.
Right. Well, that's the thinking part. And I see the biggest thing that we can do is, and I know there's immense pressures out there. We talked about it in the last episode, but when you're in charge of creating a test plan, it's mm-hmm. not just, oh, I need these samples to go into this chamber. It's
right.
What am I going to do with those results? How are they going to be interpreted? Is if you're doing just pass fail type stuff, you're really wasting a lot of resources, in my opinion.
Right.
It's yes. Think through, well, what are the risks? So that means understanding the design and what the design team is considering marginal or unknowns, or they're not sure, or it's mm-hmm. it's all the red flag things, right? New vendor, new component, new technology, new customer. All of those things start to send off signals that are input into setting up a test plan. But the test, yes. the actual work we do, whether it's on a coupon or a sample or on a full prototype, has got to actually answer a question. And if you don't know what that question is, don't do the test.
Well, yes. And the most fundamental question I have when I test something is, what is the weakness in this product?
Yeah,
but if
you already know, right? Here are the 10 things that are going to fail of this product, and we already know that. Would you do halt?
How do you know that?
Because we've just done it on. We can't get a prototype to work, or our last product has all of these issues, and 80% of the problems are in the power supply, and yeah. we have the same power supply.
Okay.
Right? Would you go halt the power supply? No, we already know what to work on. We already did the failure analysis. We already have the details. We have customer feedback that these don't work. We got to fix these.
Yeah. It's
would you do halt in that case? No.
That's
you
too
go
late.
Fix it. I mean, it's real though.
They got
but
to
people,
the customer expense is
no,
broken.
But people would take that. What you're saying is always do halt. No, it's not your exact words, but I want to push you on that.
No,
there's no such thing as a standard suite of tests.
Always test to whatever limits, test to the product's strength and limits. That's all I'm saying is find out where the product doesn't operate and if the product catastrophically breaks
right.
at different stress levels.
We're not disagreeing, but it's got to be, it's not the only thing we do, right?
No. Go. I mean, the first thing is go look at failures.
Well, no, I mean, even before that. So let's back up. What can people actually do? You know, one of the things I've run into over the years, let me throw one out at you here.
Okay.
Is you walk into a group and you ask the lead design guys, you know, of a product, so how long is this supposed to last?
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, well, the warranty's 2 years. Or
okay.
No, it should last forever. Or we can have no more than 3% failures. We can't afford more
okay.
than that.
Okay.
Okay. Well, 3% on the first day or 3% over 40 years? Does that change
yeah.
how you design the
right.
product? Right?
Yes.
It's just the basic understanding of the four elements that are required in reliability, right? There's a function. It's what's it supposed to do,
mm-hmm.
right? And that is more tricky than most people give it to. It's not in the product requirements documents oftentimes. It's in the customer's
right.
mind. It's what they
right.
want it to do.
And the customer may try an application that the designer never considered.
Well, what do you mean may? They will. That's a given.
Eventually over time, yes.
Yeah, they will, right? And
they
so
will.
It's how do you get...
Some percentage will.
Right.
Yes.
So understand what's it supposed to do in enough detail that you can actually design it and understand when it's not doing it. Because we need that in the reliability side. And where is it going to be used and under what conditions?
Right.
Now, some places, you know, our customers give us very detailed, here's the environment, here's the temperatures, here's the conditions. And others, consumer products in particular, it's all over the map.
It is all over the map
right.
because
and,
that's the way customers...
Right, but we need to understand
wherever humans
that.
Live.
That's a big part of what we need to do before we go into testing, before we look for failure mechanisms and anything else is... Designers at concept need to understand it's not just 0 to 45°C, it's what's the distribution, what's the range of these things. We can provide that information. And
well,
then the other
right.
part is, well, how long is it supposed to last under in what proportion are going to fail or are expected to fail or should fail for us to be in business, for example. And so when I hear it's got a five-year life, all right, great. Does that mean all of them fail at the end of 5 years? Or half of them have failed by then? Or none of them fail by then? So you can't just say a duration, and you can't just say a probability. It's a couplet. You have to always say that in combination. And then there's multiple points. Early failures count more.
Right? They do. They're costly. They're warranty. The company has to pay for
them. Well, then there's the warranty part. I think the first one's out-of-box failures. You know, and it would frustrate me.
Fred, those aren't something that – this is where I guess we may diverge in our view a little bit, and that is the ability to control. How much control do we have over that the cause of failures during the warranty period? Those are short-term failures that somebody – it's my opinion, this is my view, that somebody somewhere in the design or manufacturing process had an error. They did not have enough margin, or something went wrong in the manufacturing process, or something was overlooked. And that's
if you don't set a goal, right? If you don't set
you set a goal and then failures.
No, there's no such thing as zero failures.
Well, no, there can't be zero failures because customers.
But I need something I need to go look at and say if I'm not even looking at early failures, and I've seen too many organizations that say, we got a five-year product, we're going to look at things that are going to affect it out to five years, and they design, you know, systems that are robust out to five years, but they can't install it. The transport system and the act of installing this compressor damages it. And they didn't think through the installation process, and they didn't think through how would it actually move? And so the design and the packaging and the installation instructions were just and then there's surprise. So we made a five-year product. Why should we be having problems? Well, they're different fundamental failure mechanisms. They're different stresses.
Right?
And so if you don't even address it in the concept phase and include it in the design realm of consideration, it gets overlooked. So part of it is set the early ones, and because it's different kinds of things that are problems. Then there's the warranty period. Then there's how long should it actually work?
Right.
You know, for most products.
Is a phone supposed to be waterproof, or is it? I mean, water resistant, or not? Okay, those are fundamental design requirements that would make a big difference on reliability.
Right.
Okay. So, yes, I'm certain I agree with you. The specifications, the intended environment. But again, you just talked about it early in our conversation here that the customers will abuse it. The customers will take it to new technologies and new applications that weren't known before, even when the product was designed, and 3 years later come out and say, I'm going to use it for that. Okay.
Well, I heard about like an iPad kind of device. Mm-hmm. Somebody wanted to use it as a license plate. I thought, well, there's a brilliant idea. But it may come to pass. It may figure out a way to make it robust enough to car crashes and work like a bumper. But have you looked at shock damage or just crushing damage to this thing?
We're going to have to have really robust electronics because they're going to control the car.
Well, just the screen. Part of this is that it's learning, it's understanding failure mechanisms. It's I think setting the goals and getting the information needed for the early design parts, the environment, the functions and so on, is enable your design team to actually create a robust product. Is they need information that we can provide.
And so, you've told me before, and you've said it, that the design engineers design away from failure.
That's right.
But you've got to know what the failures are. And if you don't know what the failures are, you don't know what to design against, away from. So that's you're just repeating that in a different way. Restating it.
Yeah.
Yes.
But then there's also, we talked about doing lunch and learn or brown bags or educational pieces, getting senior management support. And part of that is understanding what's of value to them and putting it in those terms.
Right.
The other part is the larger part. And what you and I are doing with these podcasts and the other hosts, and we also on Ascendo Reliability, is educate the wider audience. So if somebody's looking to well, how do I interpret this Weibull plot? Well, here's an article on it. Or how do I do a halt test and get started? You know, some of our very first podcasts, Kirk, were on how many samples do you need? And what do you look for? And what measurements do you make? And so there's tons of information out there. And I think the more voices that provide that information, one, it helps you actually learn it yourself better by trying to teach it to somebody else, is make that information available and more widespread. Now, we're getting close on time here, Kirk. I want to say my number one thing, and I hope you agree, is stop using MTBF. Well, yes. Just challenge it anytime you see it. Ask them, what do they really want, right? And just say, all right, you want you want 50,000 hours MTBF.
Do you really want
two-thirds of them to fail in 5 years? Right? Is that what you really want? What is it you really want? And just ask that question.
Right.
And then give them a button if they get it, if they understand
it. Well, the question is they want it, or is there a management above them want it, and you can't get to that manager to tell him, why do you want it?
Everybody's got open door policy.
Working up the change. I know.
Everybody's got an open door policy. Just use it. You know, be bold. You're a good engineer. You understand the details. Go in and tell them that they really don't know what in the world they're asking for here.
Fred, I've had personal experience that I also can lead to an exit door. If you tell them that this is not a valid process, you know, or say, what do you really want? And if you want a reliable product, this is the way to do it. And they say, no, we want a calculation of reliability prediction. Then you either do that and get your money and you get your paycheck, or you go out and go someplace else. And that's
might just do both. So you have a little bit more time to get a better job. I understand.
Done predictions. I've done predictions.
Yeah. It's a cruel world out there.
It is cruel. So
it is. Anyway, but part of it is asking questions, challenging stuff, keep learning, share your knowledge. All of those good things are going to help. And just resist to doing MTBF. Speak out against it. Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good, Fred.
Right. I don't know how clear all that is, but good luck with the show notes.
We need more to write and speak out and get behind the change in some of the traditionally, especially prediction, those kinds of things, and more of understanding of the real causes of failures, which is a big challenge.
It is. It definitely is. But we're up to it. We can do that. The listeners of the show are more than capable. So I think together we can make this work. Right?
They're listening to find out. Listening to get new ideas too. So
yeah. So if this sparked a couple of other ideas, I know Kirk and I didn't really get into the list of the top 20 or anything, and there's lots and lots we can do to help change our industry and the way we do our business, everything from how we set standards, how do we use standards, how do we create reliability plans, how do we express ourselves to other people, how we make requests. The list is pretty extensive, and lots of little things we can do to really make a difference. So if you got some ideas on this, or if you'd like to join us in this conversation, let us know. Head over to reliability.fm, and you can find plenty of ways to add comments or suggestions there, and we'd love to hear from you. So with that, Kirk, let's go do something good today.
Okay, we'll go out and have some fun, and everybody out there, hope you do the same, and keep on listening. Right. We appreciate it.
Certainly do. Thanks, Kirk.
Thank you, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.